And I hear the doctor go, okay, so you look all right, other than a couple bruises and, like, she hurt her knee a bit. And he's like, I'm going to go check on your sister now. And Maggie goes, you don't need to do that. And the doctor's taken aback because he's an ER doctor. And he goes, why not? And she goes, well, she's quite dead. Totes my goats recording the Tron. We're making a podcast. Lydia and Naomi and all of Jonathan's skills.
Sorry, I'm congested, ladies and gentlemen.
If you raise your hand, I will also stop and cough my heart out. And then they'll just be a little, then it'll be like one time as opposed to us coughing. We'll cough
in unison. So that's like the sign is when you need to cough, you just put up your hand.
Yeah, and we'll just go.
Welcome, applauders. This is Lydia Malcolm.
And Naomi McQuaid.
And welcome to Shocked and Applaud.
Oh, applauders, you've marched through piles of snow taller than kittens. You've gone through it, and now you're here, and it's March.
Oh.
And we're in like a lion. We're out like a lamb.
Yeah, March. 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 I have no real good joke on that. Sorry, I'm really lightheaded. It's everything to do with the fact that I'm sick, but I don't care if I'm sick because I made a point to be here.
You made a commitment and you followed through.
Amen.
I am here for the work as well.
Yeah, this is no longer about pleasure. This is us just getting the podcast done.
Right. Because it's like we can edit this out because they don't need to know our process, but it's like a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, we're off schedule a little bit as far as recording goes, but yeah. We are on schedule as far as episode releases go. Yeah. And that makes us gold star.
Yeah.
Have you given us all five of our gold stars over at whatever podcasting thing you're going to rate us on?
iTunes, possibly.
Maybe you're on Spotify.
Yeah.
One star for every episode that we have fully released.
Right. Except we're on episode 7 now, so.
Mm-hmm. I mean.
Give us all the stars.
That's a good enough currency for Mario.
I'm just saying, give us our Mario points in star form.
It's a lot of experience points.
Does anybody know the Invincibility Star song by heart?
I think the cat does.
You mean the...
There you go.
That's where the star invincibility runs out. It's like... Dun, dun.
It always ends with me right over a pit, and it's like, na 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 na.
It's like that couple from SNL that is just kind of singing together, but they're just improvising the words over it.
Mm-hmm. So, Monty Python and the Quest for the Holy Grail.
Yeah, I wrote, when I was writing my notes initially, as I like to always refer to them, I wrote down Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail, and then I had to cross out the search for part because it's only Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah.
But they're doing the searching. That's the whole thing.
Yeah. I put down a podcast prediction that is going to just turn into poorly explaining one long joke about birds. Because that swallow joke shows up like, I think, 5 different times.
Yeah, that's referenced again and again.
Yeah.
And I was like, I had this conundrum because we review the movie, we go through it, but this is so iconic. That, I mean, we're boned as far as, like, not quoting the film through the entire thing.
It's, right.
Like, every other second, I'm like, oh, yeah, no, I say that. Oh, no, I say that. Oh, I remember this time that we were.
Yeah.
Just quoting this movie over and over again. It is so embedded in the nerd culture.
It is very much like Princess Bride, where it is incredibly quotable.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's just the dialogue. It's all about the dialogue. They happen to be on location. They happen to be presenting. There's fault in they struggled a lot during production. But overall, like, it's really just about the banter that these guys came up with in the writing room.
Mm-hmm.
Or however they ended up writing it and then bringing it together.
Right. So it starts out with one of the most bizarre and yet.
But are we going to talk about how we came to?
Oh, that's right.
We always start with where we came into this film. I mean, it's from 1975, so it predates us both. So it's always been on the landscape as far as movies for us. And I mean, I grew up on Monty Python, BBC style, on public broadcast, PBS.
Yeah.
Like the humor of it. I mean, I loved and continue to love Monty Python's Flying Circus for the same reasons I like this film. It's incredibly quotable. You can watch it again and again, and you catch new stuff every time, even, you know, 35, nearly 36 years later for me. So I guess it was always like somebody might bring it up and be like, oh, have you seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail? And I'd be like, do I breathe?
For me, it wasn't so much like it wasn't ingrained into my culture growing up, but I always heard references to it. And so it was always one of those things that when I got to be old enough to where I didn't have to necessarily, you know, fear my family, you know, side-eyeing me when I watched that.
My family would watch it with me. So I mean, like when you say, they'd be like, what is she doing?
Be like, Lydia, this is irreverent and it has no meaning in anything. Why are you watching that? I don't know. Like, I could just be paranoid.
Well, it's a very Charlie and the Chocolate Factory situation where, you know what? Candy isn't supposed to necessarily have a point.
Mm-hmm.
You're not gaining sustenance out of this, although you do. I mean, like, it's Monty Python is great at increasing your ability to banter, and they'll say something very smart and something very stupid, and then they're like, you know what, these two things equal footing. But I'm really sad that you felt like you were maybe kept from it because of other people's judgmental glances.
Well, it may have just been, you know, when you grow up in like a very conservative Christian home, I think it's just one of those things that isn't in their peripheral because it's seen as being too secular, and secular things by definition aren't necessarily good when you're in that kind of a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think it was like, I mean, my own paranoia could be saying things like they're going to be judging me quietly. But that might not have been the case. I think I watched Xena, Warrior Princess. And
so good.
So good. I watched The Simpsons. And the fact that my parents, you know, didn't say, okay, Lydia, you have to turn off the TV when those things go on, you know, that I think was fairly progressive. They did not have to allow that in their home. I know other people who did not have, you know, parents that were that open. Mm-hmm. So it was like, okay, I feel blessed in that regard. But
it's funny, The Simpsons was reviled when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably, oh goodness, I don't remember how old I was when The Simpsons came out, but I was only like 5-ish or something like that. It was,
yeah, like late 80s on the Tracy Ullman show, I think, it was when it first appeared.
Yeah, and then it hit the mainstream shortly thereafter. Mm-hmm. But what has happened with The Simpsons was it was like this terrible family, and how can you believe it, blah, blah, blah. And now we're like, oh, it's this nuclear family that's managed to stay together through this, all of this tumultuous time. And Monty Python is a bit like that because it was like, what is this irreverent humor that tongues in cheeks at these long established institutions, and then there's all this nonsense, and how can those things exist where you can make commentary and then also, you know, talk about a dead parrot as if that matters.
Or how people will go ahead and just play off death as though it's, you know, not that big of a deal. Like the whole sketch where they have like very like proper English people and death comes in to reap all of their souls. And they're too, what is it? They're too caught up in their own properness that they don't realize that they're about to die. And I mean, that speaks loads on, I mean, I don't even think that's just an English thing. That seems like something that could very easily happen in America.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. People are people.
Yeah.
All the time. And so this movie leads into that a lot because we've got these I don't know if you were ever into Arthurian literature, but I mean, I read Mist of Avalon and was completely wrapped up in the Lancelot, Guinevere, Arthur thing. I mean, it's all very romantic to me, but what happens when you've got that kind of romance thrust at you is that you forget that these were real people and they had all of these.
Maybe they knew a lot about, you know, European and African laden swallows.
maybe. Let's talk about that at great length.
Yes.
So now I feel like we've addressed it. We can go into it.
Opening credits with Swedish subtitles.
Black titles. I couldn't.
Dark. It's like dark and brooding music.
Yeah.
And the subtitles are like in this broken.
Okay, so they've got the English subtitles, and at the bottom they've got this, what do they call it? Like Pidgey Swedish English translation.
Yeah.
Translation is what I think the IMDb page says.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got little translations along the bottom. So it's like, directed by, and then it's like, direction by the
boom. Yeah, and then it goes, like the subtitles go into this long story about how, you know, the guy who's writing this, his sister got bitten by a moose because she was carving her initials
into the moose.
Yeah, from it was like with a toothbrush that she got from a dentist in Oslo.
An interspace toothbrush. They keep referencing moose, and moose are also put into the English subtitles. So it's like the guy who, like, the film credits make reference to things like suggestive poses for the moose suggested by Vic Rotter and things like that are like throughout the entire mm-hmm. credits. And then it talks about the person in charge of subtitles has been sacked.
Yes. And then it goes into more in-depth things about mooses.
Right back into it.
Like, they didn't actually get sacked at all, or the person who got replaced was someone who, you know, was like a fan of the mooses, just like the first subtitler.
And then the people who got sacked as well.
Yeah.
And then it happens a third time. The sackers who got sacked again.
Uh-huh.
And then they were like, so we're just going to
change up the credits altogether.
At great expense, we've gotten the rest of the credits done. And then it starts like epilepsy warning. It's like, wah, 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 with like these flashing colors in a very 70s style. And then they drop the moose thing.
Yeah, but they do replace the music, which goes from like dark and brooding to very romantic to like Mexican samba.
Yeah, and then all of the subtitles have llamas in them.
Yeah.
Just llamas, llamas, llamas. Llamas all the way down. And then it cuts off, and then we have a title card that says England, 932 AD.
Behold the English caste system in place with a king and a squire.
And we get the iconic coconut shells.
Yeah.
The King Arthur is like pretending to ride a horse, holding his little reins.
Yeah.
And he's doing this little trot skip when the guy behind him is just clapping coconut shells. And production note,
mm-hmm.
they just couldn't afford horses. They would have had them, but they couldn't afford them.
This is so much better. Like one of the ways that I knew about Monty Python was in high school. I don't think this was ever shown to me in high school. I would really be surprised if it was. But I always knew about this bit with the coconuts and the king. Because, like, every time, like, there would be, like, periodical moments where me and my best friend, Tira McCarter, who is now Tira Foley.
Shout out. She's lovely.
She is. She would, like, start banging coconuts together. And I would, like, immediately, like, get into the position of the king. And we would just go through school.
Tira had coconut shells with her?
It was, like, fake. Like, folk, you know, when mimes act.
Oh, she's just pantomiming coconut shells. And you knew to dance.
And I knew to, like, ride like a king on a horse.
That's beautiful.
It was great.
I've got high school anecdotes about this, too.
Yeah.
All right. I'm down. Let's do it.
Okay.
Okay, so we walk past the dead guy on the weird spinning thing, and I didn't take the time to look up that torture device, but it seems like we should, at some point, address it via one of our social medias. But they approach a castle.
Yeah. A lowly guard.
Who's high up for being a lowly guard?
Yeah, he's asked, you know, by Arthur, King of the Britons, to see the lord of this castle. But this guy cannot get past the fact that they are using coconuts instead of riding on horses.
And they begin to debate back and forth. He's just like, where did you get coconut shells? We're in a temperate climate.
Yeah. And Arthur's just like, you know, we
could have migrated.
And he's like, migrated?
Coconut, are you suggesting coconuts migrate? No. Okay, guys, this film is probably us. This review is going to be us faking like the scenes that we've seen over and over again. Like, and I'm sorry about that, but also you're welcome to it because it's going to be hilarious.
Yes, it's going to be poor, poor adaptation, a very poor adaptation. But the guys like can't get past the fact that they're using coconuts in an area that is that coconuts are not native to.
They're a tropical plant. Why do you got? And he's like, it could have come here. You saying coconuts migrate? It could have been carried here. By a swallow. The guard brings up the swallow. The king doesn't bring up the swallow.
Uh-huh. And it was just, it was one of those things where Arthur's just wanting to talk to the Lord.
And see if he'll help him search for the Holy Grail.
Yeah. And this knight, this guard is just like, no, let's have to address the coconut thing because I cannot wrap my brain around that.
Right, right. Wind speeds, various species of swallows, like.
Yeah, if it was.
And then there's a second guard who shows up and they start debating it.
Yeah.
What if it's an African swallow?
You have to grip it by the husks, and it would
it's
have
not
to
a
be
a question if it could grip it by the husk.
It's a question of rate ratio.
Right.
Weight to wind velocity ratio.
Yes, and there's so many, because everybody loves this film, there's so many different explanations. Like, it's, people have used it on actual physics tests. Mm-hmm. Like, they'll put in there, like, okay, African swallow. I can't imagine, like, not banging my head on the desk as a student in a math class. But, like, also, I want to high-five that teacher, yeah. So.
There's a part of me that wonders if maybe, like, it just came up through water currents.
Well, that's what I would think, because that's how coconuts are designed. They're mm-hmm. they're actually the world's largest seed.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's a thing that you know now.
Yeah. I mean, it's not going to survive in the area, but it still doesn't mean you can't have some dope coconut milk.
I mean, yeah. That's how you check if a coconut's good, by the way you shake it. Mm-hmm. And if you can hear the juice inside, then it's good to go.
Good.
And now you know that, too. But King Arthur is, like, done with this conversation. He's decided not to pursue the lord of this castle, and he and his squire wander off.
Yeah.
If you hear a bell in the background, that's our cat, Sprinkles. She just runs through every now and again. Just kind of accept it, because this is an imperfect podcasting environment.
Yeah. Sketch number two, bring out your dead.
Yes. The thing I want to point out first and foremost in this scene is the willingness of every extra in this scene to roll around in the mud.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's in the mud. Everybody's rolling in it. Guy's screaming, bring out your dead. So they're like hiding from the guy. I don't know why you'd have to hide if you're not dead, but whatever.
Well, we find out that apparently John Cleese is willing to kill one of his... Maybe it's his dad. I think he says it's his dad.
I think it's his father. Yeah.
And that's why they're probably hiding, is because they don't want to get mistaken for dead people and get killed.
Bring out your dead. Here's one for you. I'm not dead. Okay. Here's the time for my high school anecdote about this scene.
Yeah.
A month after I started dating Jonathan, which will be 20 years ago next month in proportion to this podcast. So Jonathan and I started dating in April of 99. And a month later, on May 3rd, or it might have been May 4th, I got in a car accident with my sister. We were driving into school and we got T-boned and nobody got super duper hurt, which is great. But we still went to the ER to get checked out. And it was weird because it was the first time I was ever in the ER as a patient. And they'd separated me from Maggie and my mother. And there was a partition between us and I was just laying there alone, listening to them having a conversation. And I was like, this is really, really strange, because I was coming out of shock like you do. And I hear the doctor go, okay, so you look all right, other than a couple bruises and like she hurt her knee a bit. And he's like, I'm going to go check on your sister now. And Maggie goes, you don't need to do that. And the doctor is taken aback because he's an ER doctor. And he goes, why not? And she goes, well, she's quite dead. And I'm alone and we're only a partition away. And I go, I'm not dead yet. She goes, shut up. Yes, you are. And I'm like, but I feel better now. Be quiet. Soon be dead. I'd like to go for a walk. And my mother starts cracking up. The doctor is shocked at first and then is starting to crack up. And I'm like, I feel like singing.
I feel fine. I feel happy.
You feel happy? It's so good. I mean, like, just like, I like how people sometimes burst out into song in real life. When, like, a group of people get the same thing and start quoting it at the same time, it feels so good. I mean, mm-hmm. we don't have nearly enough of that in our culture.
Right.
So, like, getting to be able to Monty Python it up in an ER, you know, nearly 20 years ago,
mm-hmm.
it's just a delight. And it's one of my best memories of a really crappy morning.
Yeah.
So that's my anecdote about I feel better.
That's good. That's good.
But the guy won't die. So then the guy with the cart bashes him over the head and throws him in the cart. And that's when King Arthur trots by with his...
And one of the guys is like, who's that?
He's like, he must be king of something.
Why?
He don't have shit all over him. I read that was ad-libbed.
Yeah, well, I love ad-libbed moment.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Me too. That's what this podcast is all about.
Yeah, we don't keep notes.
Mm-hmm.
Notes be damned.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyways, then
they're through the countryside
and we see the guy on the stick plate the second time. And personally, I would have liked to have seen this guy on a stick plate.
Are you talking about the dead? These the are dead corpse.
Guy. Yeah.
It's weird because you'd think it'd be like a cross or some other like really recognizable form of torture and or death. But it really does look like a wagon wheel on top of a stick and it's got a skeleton on top.
Right. And I think it would have been funny to see that, like, reoccurring, because they use the castle more than once. They just shoot it from different angles.
Yeah, because they got their filming in Ireland, Scotland, I think, revoked. So yeah. They were like, we got this, like, other place. We'll just shoot it from different angles.
Yeah. And so I think it would have just been, like, a little bit, like a nod and a wink to the audience saying, see, we had to, like, use the same scene, and we're kind of, like, leaning into that rather than trying to back away. And
there was a character that was cut who was a fourth wall breaker, and he was supposed to do that throughout the entire film, making fun of when they made sets that would fall over or like why they did something in an obvious and stupid way to cut costs because the budget was so low for this film. But they cut all of that fourth wall character and only had that one squire say, it's only a model. That's it. That's all they kept of that character. But that doesn't come up yet. And I'm sorry I dropped that bomb beforehand, but enjoy.
That's okay.
It's only a model.
So Arthur and his squire Patsy come across a group of workers in the field.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. He's like, madam, I'm not a madam. Oh, yeah, old man. I'm 37.
My name is Dennis. Like, I didn't know that.
Dennis is just an obstinate character, but also King Arthur is kind of a king who's kind of a jerk. I mean, in that he's got this authority that, you know, he assumes.
Yeah, my note on this is that the whole exchange between Dennis the socialist and Arthur the divinely inspired king
monarchy.
It feels
monarchist.
It feels like a lot of political debates even today. Like you have one side that is just spouting a lot of words that ultimately aren't going to make sense to the common man, and then you got a king who's trying to overplay his right to be king through divinity, through like divine or like
it addresses that. I'm sorry for cutting you off, but it addresses that whole thing where, you know, I loved Mists of Avalon, but it's a lot of fairy tale. And so when the guy is just like, what, a lady, a saucy tot in the water gives you the right to be king? We elect our people and change our government regularly and blah, blah, blah. And what my note says is, talking government is hilarious, but impossible to relate to a podcast. Like, I know, when I was watching this, I was just like, that's not going to happen. There's no way to relate this scene without quoting it word for word.
I know.
That relates the fact that this guy knows more about government than the king does. But the king's like, I've got authority. And he's like, no. So eventually the king is just like, let's take this guy away.
Yeah.
And then the guy says,
I'm being repressed.
Now we see violence inherent in the system. It's so good because, like, we all know people who want to talk politics till it gets violent.
I know.
And I'm not saying there's stuff that doesn't need changing. This isn't that podcast.
Right. We do not talk politics on this podcast, which is a political statement in and of itself, but we're not going down that road.
This is a comedy entertainment podcast.
Yeah.
And we're not looking for that kind of discussion.
Right. Forest shots cut with two guys fighting in armor. So there's like this back and forth.
It cuts after, and cuts and cuts.
After the scene with the peasantry where Arthur is just going with that, the music that da, 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 da.
Yes. And then it cuts to like a fighting scene where it's like, back, bang, boom, boom, boom. Green Knight and Black Knight are fighting.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Black Knight wins, kills the Green Knight. And Arthur approaches the Black Knight and says, Sir Knight, you have fought valiantly. Will you please join me on my quest for the Holy Grail? Or, sorry, will you come and join me to be my Knights of Camelot? Because he doesn't get the quest for the Holy Grail until later on.
Oh, yeah. Probably messed that up earlier.
That's sorry. Okay.
But here's where I realized in my notes that we go from what I'd like to call a vignette to another vignette. We cut, because their roots are in sketch comedy, we get sketch after sketch after sketch. And yes, they're related, and yes, there are things that run through them. Their shows, Monty Python and the Flying Circus, often had running gags throughout the entire episode, right? But and this is no different, but as it is a movie format, it's interesting to recognize that we're going from sketch to sketch to sketch. It just happens to be a movie.
Right. And the transitions are relatively well done. Mm-hmm. You can generally gauge a transition because they're going to be walking through the woods, at least in this movie.
Mm.
So even though they're rooted in sketch comedy, they still recognize that this is a movie and there needs to be a specific way of like moving things forward, and there needs to be more of a flow than just, you know, like one this is where the sketch stops and we're gonna fade out and then fade back in to the next sketch.
Yeah, this is I think their second movie. I think their first one was And Now for Something Completely Different, mm-hmm. and that was much more modeled after their show, and this one was like their first one with like a throughout plot line,
mm-hmm.
a story that has kind of a known history. People aren't, I mean, especially I suppose more so than here in Great Britain, they're gonna have Arthurian legend like everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They're gonna have it shoved up their nose from when they were little, at least to some degree. So let's talk about the Black Knight, who just the king after the part you said where he's just mm-hmm. like, come and join me on my Camelot, just dead silence.
Yeah, and Arthur tries to go past him and he says,
none shall pass.
And then Arthur's just like, excuse me,
none shall pass.
I move for no man.
Yes.
At one point, that was a pretty cool, that was a pretty cool line. Because he's standing his ground, man.
Yeah.
And so they fight, and Arthur is victorious.
Yeah.
Because he cuts off his arm.
He cuts off his arm, and then he cuts off his first arm. I mean, they battle pretty good. It's mm-hmm. not as greatly choreographed as the Green Knight, Black Knight scene. But I think those two actors were enjoying it more, and this was more integral to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
So Arthur cuts off the knight's arm and is like, all right, I'm done.
Yeah, and the knight's just sort of like, no.
It's but a flesh wound. got that on a t-shirt, no lie.
I can see why. It is one of the most quotable lines in this movie. Like, at some point, Arthur says, your arm's off.
He's like, no, it isn't.
Just a flesh wound.
Just a flesh wound. Then he cuts off, King Arthur cuts off his second arm. I've got to say, as a fan of, like, when body parts are dismembered, we've talked about it, I think, in Tusk. Yeah. Call back. Like, when body parts go off, like, it's a mechanics thing for me. Like, is it CGI? Is it, oh, no, really, the guy's arm is behind his back in his outfit? Yeah.
This is so obviously fake. I kind of can't hate it because it's like, again, it's leaning into the fact that it, you know, it's not something that's supposed to be taken accurate.
I'm gonna blow your mind. They hired a one-legged blacksmith to play the knight when he's one-legged. And I think one of the directors was like, and so when he cuts off his other leg, we only had to dig one hole. but then John Cleese, who plays the Black Knight, was like, no, I remember standing in a hole. So I don't know if they used him, but I did read that they hired a one-legged guy.
Yeah. So Arthur cuts off one hand. Guy's like, whatever. Arthur cuts off another arm. Guy's like, whatever.
Let's keep fighting. What are you going to do? Bleed on me?
Arthur cuts off one of his legs, and he's hopping on his one leg while running into Arthur.
Ineffectually.
And when Arthur... Yeah.
I'm sorry. I always want to butt in when I have something fun.
Oh, go for it.
They made a marionette. There's a production photo where they've got a guy on a ladder holding a Black Knight with one leg with, like, on a string. And then the guy swings at his leg.
And so he's like, the Black Knight is always triumph.
He's like, I've beaten you. And he's like, we'll call it a draw.
It's like, your confidence is disproportionate to your abilities at this point.
You're a loony. I love that. I'm going to start calling people a loony.
And so only when this guy has lost both of his arms and both of his legs, he's like, okay, we'll call it a draw. But then taunts Arthur as he's walking away. He's like, I'll bite your legs off.
I'll take you both together. Okay, the bridge is very small, which reminds me of Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Oh, yeah.
But also, a callback to a Monty Python sketch that this reminds me of is, did you ever watch the Department of Arguments?
No.
Okay, the scene opens up and a guy comes in and he goes, I'm here for an argument. And he goes, no, you're not. He's like, yes, I am. I paid my money and I came in here for an argument. And the guy's like, no, you didn't. And the guy's like, an argument is not just an opposing view, an oppositional view. And he goes, yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. And it's one of the best John Cleese skits I have ever seen because really, an argument is just a contrary up, like, a, or contradicting point. Yeah. Contradictory point. So the fact that, like, the Black Knight's like, no, I'm not. I'm fine. No, you're bleeding to death. No, I'm not. Like, I'm like, oh, John Cleese. Mm-hmm. Probably. And I hate to make such a bold statement, but my favorite Monty Python.
We go into Monk's.
Oh, I'm sorry. One last thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to one last thing you to death.
No, that's
on this.
Okay. That's okay.
King Arthur puts his sword away bloody, and that is not good sword work. You always wipe off your sword before you put it back. It's going to rust in the scabbard.
Mm-hmm.
Be educated.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a magical sword. My notes now say Latin saying, look it up.
Yeah, there's a bunch of monks speaking in Latin, and then they're hitting their heads on a board. Yeah.
Paelesus Domine. Donne's Requiem.
That's close enough.
I wrote it down. That's exactly right.
I think it's Iesu Domine Donne's Requiem.
Take it up with IMDb.
Donne's Requiem is an actual phrase.
You know, the whole thing
find.
Is an actual phrase from a Latin mass. I looked it up.
What does it say?
It says, Merciful Lord Jesus, grant them rest.
Paelesu Domine, Donne's Requiem.
That was good. I don't know, that first one was good because it hit the mic.
You should do one of the little, I hate these springs make noise so much, but you could do one right now. You could do a Donne's Requiem.
I don't know where my spring is.
Oh, it's like further down.
Oh, yeah, it's here. Okay. Okay.
Go for it.
Donne's Requiem.
It's too much. It's too much. Yeah, what's good is when it's like.
Thuds. The specific thud.
So we get the monks moving through, doing their Latin spiel, hitting their heads on their wooden blocks. And then we see this knight tying a coconut to a pigeon.
Okay, some people would argue that it's a dove because it's got albinism.
Yeah.
But a dove is a pigeon, so I don't fault you.
Okay. But and then an angry mob brings a witch.
A witch! She's a witch!
Not just heavily explained in the narrative, which to us as the audience seems like a pretty far reach as far as, like, if she weighs the same as a duck, she must be a witch.
She must be made out of wood, which makes her... Here's my note, though. It's the thing that Monty Python does again and again and again super freaking well is idiot logic.
Mm-hmm.
She turned me into Newt!
I got better.
I think John Cleese again, like, my heart, but, like...
She cut off my legs and made me into a walrus.
The term is megafauna.
Okay.
This is going to be the one episode where I'm not cracking up half the time.
No,
because I will throw out my voice.
Idiot logic. Like, okay, but when they're like, what weighs the same, what also floats in water? And everybody's like, I don't know. And then King Arthur steps forward and he goes, a duck! And Sir Burnham turns around and he's like, oh, a fellow scientist! A fellow genius! And I'm like, no, you're just following idiot logic. I'm okay with you following idiot logic, but between us right now, recognize that Monty Python excels in people who are like, justifying my point! Neither science, nor logic, nor natural occurrence in any manner substantiates this, but I can argue the point until I feel right enough.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing about arguing a point until you feel right enough. That doesn't make you right. But in the world of, in this world, in the Monty Python world, idiot logic explained well enough and logically enough, like, they end up weighing, because a duck floats in water and wood floats in water and witches are made out of wood, whatever.
Then she has to, if she weighs the same as a duck, she must be a witch.
Okay, so they put the suspected witch and a duck in this levy weight system, weighing system, like a scale and balance sort of
thing. Yeah.
And she weighs the same as the duck, and then she goes, that's a fair cop.
But here's the thing. We know in our world, no human can ever weigh the same as a duck, because ducks have less mass per volume than we do. I think that I said that right.
No, that seems exactly right. The thing that makes me mad about this scene is that I know that there's a difference between weight and buoyancy. Mm-hmm. Weight has a factor in buoyancy, but if an item weighs less than the water it displaces, then it's going to float. Mm-hmm. That's how boats work.
Yeah.
So, like, the amount of weight, I mean, like, a big cargo ship weighs a ton, right? Mm-hmm. But because it's spread out, the size and shape of it displaces less water than it weighs.
Right.
Did I say that right?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Okay, so a big freaking heavy boat, which probably weighs more than a duck, floats.
Yeah.
But it makes me mad because their idiot logic, flawless. Me in the background being like, buoyancy and weight, not the same thing. Although correct, to whatever degree I can communicate it, is incorrect in this movie's line. Sorry, we have to move
there
past
is a
it.
Line of logic, though, in within the scene transitions, which is kind of cool, because it starts off with this encounter with an individual who is attacking the system, or the people, as it were, the government. And then we encounter the knight, who is very individualistic and has no intention of relying on anybody's will but his own. And then we transition into the crowds attacking one individual. So we have this kind of weird transition period between scenes, especially for a Monty Python sort of way, because you do expect a bit of random transition, but there's also a sort of streamlined way of encountering these different perceptions through the extras or the added characters.
What's the name of that knight?
I have no idea. I did not bother to take his name down.
The scientist
Benavir.
One. I wrote it down as Beravane. That's not right.
Handlebar mustache guy.
The continuously mask falling down guy.
The science guy who can't science good.
I mentioned it to you, but they auctioned off his helmet.
Yeah.
And it sold for, I forget how many times the price they thought it would sell. I think it's more than 10 times they thought it would sell.
Mm-hmm.
But it was $29,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like two or three times my car.
Mm-hmm.
And that hurts me in the face.
In the face.
Sir Bedivere.
Bedivere.
Bedevere.
Okay.
Bedivere.
You know, this is the one knight that's with Arthur the longest.
He makes it through.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually the guy at the end.
Yeah.
Nobody else makes it through.
No.
I mean, like, one guy survives. It's just he doesn't make it to the end scene.
Right. So, for the sake of brevity, the film...
For the sake of Bedivere.
Bedivere. The film produces a book about the film and goes through the other knights that are joining, like Galahad, the Chaste, Lancelot, and Robin.
Lancelot is spelled two different ways in the flipping of this book, by the way.
That's good, that's good. And then there was the knight who was not appearing in this film.
So not appearing in this film was the baby of Michael Palin. Palin?
Mm.
It was his infant son. His infant son named William.
Oh.
So you're welcome for letting me read that IMDb page.
And as it's going through this book, you see this very nice manicured hand, which Naomi pointed out is the hand of Terry Gilliam's wife.
Mm-hmm.
And then a gorilla hand comes over it and takes it away and then starts turning the pages. And you noted that the gorilla hand was Terry Gilliam.
Yeah. I mean, if I was going to be absconded with by a gorilla hand, I'd want it to be Jonathan's.
Have you already outlined that his hand servant is Patsy? Patsy is Terry Gilliam.
No, I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But thanks for saying so. Patsy,
aside from the knight that you aside from Bedivere, this is the character that's with Arthur the longest.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, he's there until I think they dismount and go on foot.
Mm-hmm. I think when they dismount before reaching the cavern with the monster rabbit, I think he stops being with them at that point.
Mm-hmm. But Bedivere,
yeah.
Is that how we're going to say it?
Yeah.
Bedivere agrees to join up with King Arthur, assignment yet unknown.
To become part of his Knights of the Round Table.
So he's got a small troop with him now, mm-hmm. and he's headed out to Camelot.
And then when they get to Camelot, it cuts into a musical number about the Knights of the Round Table.
I don't know if you got the time for this, applauders, but here's what you got to do. Go on YouTube, pull up Bing, Google Lego Camelot song. I know people got Lego overload, but like... the Lego version of this song is so good.
It is.
That you should just watch that. I mean, like, in this film, if you're watching it anyway, it's great. But watching Lego people do it is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
But who's your favorite person in the scene? I mean, they kick a cat, a guy pushes a pram a lot, but like, what's your favorite part? Because if it's not the same as mine, I don't know if we can be friends anymore.
It's the guy who's hanging up and he's jamming out at the song.
The guy,
he's
got his, the like dudgeon guy who's like,
he is really happy about this song. It's very catchy. He's like, yeah, I can totally groove to this. I mean, I'm imprisoned by these people, but...
I mean, they have a good time.
Yeah.
They really do.
You know, I like to think that they do this a lot. And so he is like, I mean, it makes prison probably a lot more enjoyable knowing that you got entertainment.
Yeah, yeah. I think what King Arthur... So they do this whole musical number, which I'm sure... You guys are singing in the car or at work, totally annoying your coworkers, or like by yourself while you're folding laundry. I don't know what you're doing right now, guys, but like you're probably like already by yourself.
I have to push the pram along.
Yeah, anybody that went through like high school choir and heard any of the baritone or bass men as they were trying to pick up their high school voice and move past their crackiness. They all experienced this need and this desire, I heard, to just sing that one portion of the song.
As a trio, I don't think any of us were choir nerds, though. Were you a nerd? That kind of nerd? Were you that brand of nerd?
Nerd?
Were you a choir nerd?
I was in choir for a couple of quarters. Choir quarters. I like to push the promenade. You know, it was a big deal. You had to sing that part if you were a baritone or a bass.
Naomi's making her Muppet face at this point.
Sorry.
How girl sopranos have to be able to sing.
Jonathan, I think it's safe to say I don't know.
Here again.
No, I don't know. There's a lot about soprano chicks.
Apparently,
that I don't know.
Somebody went in. Yeah, I had choir, and we both had drama.
Yeah, the closest I got to choir was I guess in like eighth grade, I took a quarter of choir and they made us sing What Would You Do with the Drunken Sailor, and they kept pushing me to do an octave that I wasn't comfortable with, but that's as close as I ever got.
All right, so
turn to King Arthur, who says, you can do it.
One second thought. It is a silly place.
Did you have any knee-jerk reactions to discovering we'd be reviewing 1975's Monty Python and the Holy Grail of Plotter? We tried our best to keep it a secret, but we're apparently on a mission from on high to deliver the goods. Hey, this is your audio engineer and wafer-thin mint man, Jonathan, reminding you that if you couldn't possibly take any more of our Python references, there's still more left on our digital platters to serve up to your physical ear holes. We'd like to give a shout-out to Tamara, who tagged us with what she does while listening and was randomly chosen to receive a digital download of her entire unbleeped season 1 catalog. Way to go for listening closely all the way to my lonely outros, Tamara. As a reminder, our $5 Patreon applauders can help sustain the show and get our unbleeped episodes 4 days before everyone else gets the public release. Just search for Shocked and Applaud on Patreon.com to become one of our highly lauded Patreon applauders. Feeling repressed out there in the real world? We'll be back in 1 week with part two of this absurdist British satire. Just in time for that Brexit thing to continue being a thing. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.